Colossians 4:6 through 4:11. The 16th talk in a series on Colossians was presented by Ron Julian on October 31, 1999 at Reformation Fellowship. The copyright for this recording is held by Gutenberg College, Inc., 1999. Gutenberg College is a non-profit organization, and contributions may be made at www.gutenberg.edu. This material may be copied and distributed in whole for non-commercial and educational purposes, subject to the inclusion of this introduction, all other rights reserved. A brief break occurs in the middle of the following recording. It is the result of the original audio tape switching to the second side.
Well, we're going to take our last look in our series on Colossians. We're right at the very end of the book. We've been talking about Colossians for some time, and what I'd like to say is we've come to the big slam-bang finish, and we're going to really go out with a big crescendo and bring home the message of the book in a powerful way. The problem is that's not the way letters usually go. Letters, you kind of hit your stride somewhere in the middle, and then by the time you get to the end, you sort of dribble off with, well, make sure you just say hello to Fred and Joe and Sally. So that's kind of what we have here. I have a couple of things to talk about in the end of the book, and I tried to decide whether I wanted to do a big retrospective wrap-up of the book and kind of preach the whole thing again to you. I decided not to. What I'm going to do is say my piece, get out quickly, and hopefully give us an opportunity for any questions or comments you may have over today or anything that we've been talking about. So I hope we have some time for some discussion. We're in verse 5 of chapter 4 of Colossians. Verses 5 and 6 are basically what I want to talk about. Conduct yourselves with wisdom toward outsiders, making the most of the opportunity. Let your speech always be with grace, seasoned as it were with salt, so that you may know how you should respond to each person. Well, I wanted to talk to you a little bit about this, sort of as a model of how I think we ought to go about thinking about verses like this. The problem is that these are a short couple of little verses. They kind of come in out of nowhere, and there are a number of things that we might do with them. It sounds like, the way I've typically heard this taught, and this may be right, this may be, in fact, what Paul is saying, is this is kind of advice for witnessing. Each time you talk to a non-Christian, you have an opportunity that you shouldn't waste. So you're supposed to make the most of every opportunity that you get. And so you should get in the habit of saying something gracious but provocative every time you're talking to a non-Christian. You know, just kind of get a little zinger in there each time you're talking to them to make them think about Jesus or their own sin or something like that. Maybe that's what Paul means. It's possible. It could be what he means. But as I have talked about before, as we've gone through Colossians, it is interesting that Paul seems to have written the letter to the Ephesians very, very close in time to this letter to the Colossians. It's going to the same region, basically. Paul's in jail. He's sending a couple of fellows with some letters from him to this region in Asia Minor. And one of the letters is this letter to the Colossians, and another one is the letter to the Ephesians. And there are a lot of parallels in Ephesians and Colossians. Colossians seems to be written more specifically with the Colossians in mind. I know the specific historical circumstances that you're in, Colossians, and here's my word to you. Here's what I want to say to you, Colossians. The letter to the Ephesians seems to be, if it even is to the Ephesians, which is, there's some doubt about whether that's the way to understand the beginning, seems to be more like a general letter. It doesn't have any real details. It's not really addressed specifically to people, and here's the problem you're facing, and here's what I want to say to you, but seems to be a more general kind of letter. But if you look at that difference between them, there are a number of places where what he says in Ephesians lines up closely or not so closely with what he says in Colossians. That being the case, there's an interesting little chunk in Ephesians that I wanted to take you to look at. It's in chapter 5. We're in 5. Let me start reading to you in verse 11. And do not participate in the unfruitful deeds of darkness, but instead even expose them. For it is disgraceful even to speak of the things which are done by them in secret. But all things become visible when they are exposed by the light. For everything that becomes visible is light. For this reason it says, "Awake, sleeper, and arise from the dead, and Christ will shine on you." Therefore, be careful how you walk, not as unwise men, but as wise, redeeming the time, because the days are evil. So then, do not be foolish, but understand what the will of the Lord is. Okay, well, the verse 15 and 16 in Ephesians 5, "Therefore, be careful how you walk." That word is the same in the verse that we're looking at. It's translated, "conduct yourselves with wisdom," but literally it's "walk in wisdom toward outsiders" in our passage in Colossians. It says, "not as unwise men, but as wise." And in our passage it says, "walk with wisdom." And then there's this phrase, "redeeming the time," which is actually more literally what we have in the New American Standard. It says, "making the most of the opportunity." But more literally, it's "redeeming the time." So this phrase, "redeeming the time," shows up in both of the passages in Ephesians and in Colossians in a sentence that's talking about how you walk and doing it with wisdom. So it's intriguing, to say the least, that the phrase, what Paul means when he says, "walk in wisdom toward outsiders, redeeming the time," that he may have in mind the sort of thing that he says in Ephesians when he says, "therefore be careful how you walk, not as unwise men, but as wise, redeeming the time, because the days are evil." So, if there were that parallel, if what he has in mind with the one phrase in Colossians is similar to what he means in Ephesians, what does it mean? What would he be getting at? Well, in both passages he talks about how you walk, which is fairly clear, how you live your life. But in the Ephesians passage, it's very clearly in a context where he's talking about how they walk, how they conduct themselves as they live in the world, surrounded by unbelievers, surrounded by what he calls deeds of darkness. There is a foolishness in the world. You're living in the middle of that darkness and that foolishness. Don't get caught up in it, he's saying. How you walk ought to reflect what you understand to be true as a believer. Don't let the world suck you in to its way of looking at things and thinking about things. He says, not as unwise, but as wise. Now, in the Colossians passage, if we think about him as talking about how you witness to people, walk in wisdom toward outsiders, we might think, well, what he's saying is, I need to be canny. I need to be clever about how I approach outsiders. I've got this opportunity, and I need to use some wisdom. Don't just, you know, talk about the weather or something. Use some wisdom and get in there and get a little zinger in or something like that. That's the way I've often heard it taught. But the kind of wisdom he's talking about in Ephesians is very different. This is the difference between folly and wisdom. You're living in a world that is foolish. You're living in a world where people spend their time pursuing evil and foolish things. And the other things they pursue, if they're not evil, they may be just a waste of time, dissipation, just a way of kind of spending the time doing something to keep yourself entertained or happy or something like that. So in Ephesians, his concern is that they walk in wisdom, not foolishness. Don't follow the world around you into foolishness. then when he says redeem the time in Ephesians, he doesn't mean, hey, you have an opportunity to evangelize, make the most of it. No, he's saying the days are evil, so you need to redeem them. You're living in a world where the people around you, the season of life that they have is being wasted away. They don't know God. They're not pursuing God. They're not running after eternal life. They're not coming to understand what's really true. And so, in essence, their time has been sold off. It's gone. It has become unuseful. What you need to do is buy that time back. The days are evil. But don't follow the world around you into that evil. Buy the time back. Give yourself over to wisdom, not to folly. So, in the Ephesians passage, he's not saying, make the most of every opportunity to evangelize. He's saying, in the midst of a wicked world, hold on to the truth, hold on to wisdom instead of folly, and devote yourself, live your life in such a way that you are given over to following the truths of the gospel, that wisdom is your watchword. That's the star that you're guiding by. Don't let the world suck you into its darkness. That's the warning that he's giving in Ephesians. Well, I think it's very possible that that's what he's using the phrase for in Colossians as well. Again, literally, what it says is, walk in wisdom toward outsiders, redeeming the time. Your word always with grace, seasoned with salt, to know how you ought to answer each one. That phrase, redeeming the time, if it means a similar sort of thing in Colossians, then the picture there as well is, as I am relating to what he's calling outsiders, those outside the faith, I am dealing with those, just as we see in Ephesians, who don't understand, who don't see life the way I ought to see it, the way they ought to see it. And the question is, what's going to happen to me in that context? What am I going to do? It's so easy to, in the midst of the world, become a part of the world in my thinking. When I'm talking with people who don't share my values as a believer, it is easy for me to kind of get in step with them. Because after all, the fact is that what we believe as Christians is distinctive in this world. It is looked down on in this world. I just read an article last night. A friend of mine showed it to me. I am not a huge computer gaming sort of person, but there are a couple of computer games that I have loved with a deep passion. I love these games. I know many Christians would just absolutely be aghast at this, but the fact is that Myst and its sequel, Riven, are just, they're marvelous creations as far as I'm concerned. I love them. They're the most fun I ever had with a computer, is those two games. As Brian has said, he's told us several times, if he ever has amnesia, make sure that we take him back to play Myst and Riven again, so that he can have the experience all over again. And I would feel the same way. Okay. So I'm telling you all this to tell you I read this article, which was an interview with one of the brothers who was the responsible for those games. They're Christians. Their dad is a pastor and a missionary. And you can tell, I think, that there's something different about their perspective on things that comes through in that game. Not that there's nothing explicitly Christian in those games at all, but there's some sense that the goal of this game is not to dismember as many people as possible, or that there's some sense of that there is this world where something is wrong, but there is this right out there that it's being judged against. So it's very interesting. So it's this interview with Which one? Not Rand. The other guy. Robin. Right. Robin Miller. Well, this interview was in a very hip, sophisticated computer magazine called Wired, if any of you have ever seen it. And it was very interesting. Obviously, Robin Miller is a very hip and groovy guy in the computer world, except for the fact that he's a Christian. And you could see them sort of, you know, I mean, he's creative, and it's like, you know, it's this wonderful thing that he's done, and then they kind of have to apologize for his Christianity along the way, like, you know, this strange aberration, you know. And they sort of admitting, you know, Christian belief is not, like, real prevalent in the gaming world that's out there. I mean, that doesn't come through in most of the games that you see out there. Well, it was just striking to me, even here. I mean, here's a guy who has really won the respect of the world in just about any way you can do it. He's creative. He's successful. He's rich. I mean, he made a ton of money off of those games. Myst is that's the best-selling game for a computer that has ever been written. But there's just this problem about him. He believes in Jesus. I mean, like, he really does. I mean, like, he even talks about it in the interview. I mean, like, he uses that language that Tolkien and C.S. Lewis would use, that Christianity is a myth that is true. He says, and it's that little kicker in there that I'm saying it's true, that it's just like, well, what are we supposed to do with that? So we understand. I mean, you've had the experience. We all understand the experience that in this world, it is a lot easier to not be a Christian than to be one. And it's easier in those contexts to sort of just back up a little bit. Now, I'm not saying that my job in life is to go out and push my Christianity in the face of everybody that I meet. I don't mean that. But nonetheless, you feel that sense that it would just be easier in these dealings that I have with my friends and the people I work with and so on that are not believers, it would be easier to back off and to be, you know, I'm going to explore another side of my personality within, other than my Christianity. You know, with my computer friends, we talk about computers, and with my Christian friends, we talk about Christian stuff, and with my non-Christian friends, we just talk about other interests, and we don't go there. Well, Paul is recognizing, I think, in Ephesians, definitely he's recognizing, that we are fragile, weak creatures who can get blown around by the stuff around us so easily. It is so easy for us to get sucked in to what's happening in the world around us. I mean, and we're fools if we think that we're not susceptible, if we're not ready to go where the world around us is going. We are ready to go there. We're ready to go there very easily. So, in Ephesians, I think, Paul, in saying redeem the time, is he's saying you need to, if you just go the way the world is going, then the season of your life, this period of time that you have been given, is just going to drift away into nothingness. It's not going to count for anything. It's not going to take you anywhere. In the end, it will be as if you never really had it, because it's going to just sort of evaporate. And in the end, you will have nothing. This is the time to grab a hold of the season that you have and make something of it. And I don't mean get out there and do big things for God. I mean you personally facing the choice, what am I about? Am I looking for the kingdom of God? Am I looking for the redemption that is found in Christ? Am I looking for God's grace? Am I looking for His mercy? Or am I looking for something else? That's the question. Don't let the world around you convince you that you're looking for something else, I think, is basically what he's getting at in Ephesians. And I suspect that that's what's in his mind in Colossians as well, when he's talking about walking in wisdom toward outsiders. That the issue is, when I'm out there dealing with the people, when we go away from here, where it's pretty safe, and we get out there in the midst of a world that is dedicated to all kinds of stuff, the question is, am I going to walk in wisdom or not? Am I going to continue to follow what I know is wise and good? Or am I going to be sucked into where the world is going? Now, I am not at all being dogmatic about this meaning of the passage in Colossians. It's short, it's cryptic, and it could very well, it's possible for it to mean just, you know, hey, when you're talking to other people, you know, talk about Jesus as much as possible. Maybe that's what it means. I just think if we are to look at how Paul uses this phrase in other places and the parallelism between Ephesians and Colossians, that the odds are, I think it's more likely that he means something that I think is ultimately more profound and more in keeping with the message of this book. Because remember who he's writing to here. He's writing to a group of people who have been listening to the people around them and deciding that at least they're facing the potential choice that the gospel as Paul preached it is not really good enough, that it's something else that we want. This whole letter is a profound letter of warning. And so it would make sense that he would conclude with what is in essence not evangelism strategy, but a warning that I need to be wise as I'm dealing with the world around me. That just seems to me to fit a lot better in the letter. So right now, if you ask me, I have to vote. That's what I would say it is that it's saying. Certainly the passage in Ephesians is saying that, and that warning is one that we need to take to heart. We talk a lot around here about the world, because the Bible talks about the world. Worldliness is one of those issues that is a deep and profound one as far as the Bible is concerned. We need to be careful that we try to fill in and understand what it is that's involved with that. It's been so common, you know, in fact, you know what I'm going to say. I mean, it's almost a cliche on the other side anymore, but the fact is that we in the Christian community have tended to equate worldliness with doing things that people in the world enjoy doing. So playing cards is being worldly. Dancing is worldly. Going to movies is worldly, or something like that. And so we are not of this world by having a different culture. We don't play cards. We have fellowship. We don't watch movies. We watch, you know, Christian singers singing songs or something. I don't know, whatever it might be. I mean, but we have our own culture. And I think we have gotten the idea that somehow to escape worldliness, what you do is replace the world's culture with your own culture. And that's not what I understand Paul to be talking about. And that's not when the Bible is warning us against the world and being like the world, that's not what it's saying. It's not saying come up with your own culture. Because frankly, the culture that we've come up with is just as capable of being worldly in the biblical sense as the one we have replaced it with. Worldliness is to have your focus on this world. To say, the decisions that I make need to be made in the light of what I have here in front of my eyes. I know right now that if I do X, Y, and Z, things will go well for me here. I'll make more money, I'll have more friends, I'll have more security, I'll be entertained, whatever it might be. To think that the bottom line is what happens to me in this world is to be worldly. When the Pharisees prayed, but they prayed in such a way to make sure that everybody saw that they were praying and thought highly of them as religious people, Jesus said, they're hypocrites. And in a very, very telling phrase, they have their reward in full. They got what they were looking for. Do you see what I'm saying? I mean, sure, the prayer was about God. They're talking to God. They're expressing their thanks to God. This is a very godly exercise in theory. But if the goal is that I can think of myself and you can think of me as a religious person, and now I have gotten my reward, it doesn't really matter. I'm not really counting on God to come along and bless me with eternal life at the end. that wasn't really what I had in mind. What I had in mind is you come along and bless me with thinking that I'm really a spiritual person. I got the blessing I was looking for. When Jesus said, you got your reward in full, that's the essence of what you would say to a worldly person. You got it now. You got what you were looking for. Well, that's what people who don't understand what the faith is all about, of course, are going to be all about. Well, I mean, where else do you have to go? If I don't have the promises of God, if I don't understand the real problem that I have as a human being, the problem that Paul has been spelling out in Colossians, if I don't understand my guilt before God, if I don't understand my need for the cross of Christ, as he has eloquently talked about throughout the letter, if I don't understand how that gives me an inheritance with the saints in light, as he talked about, that I have this inheritance, there is this glory out there that is mine, that I have because what Jesus did. If I don't understand those things, then where else am I going to go but to the stuff around me? I mean, everybody cares about their own welfare, so if I can't see that what God is doing and has promised to do is where the real thing is to be found, then I'm going to have to find a substitute, and I'll find whatever's out there. Well, you and I are almost as easily distracted by those substitutes as those who do not know God at all. We are not by any means exempt from the pull of that thought that somehow this is it. I can step back, maybe here today on Sunday morning, we can talk about it and I can remember, oh yeah, this isn't it, all there is. But it's really easy to get out there and to slip back into that thinking, this is all there is. I've got to make sure that this happens because this is all there is. If I don't get this, I lose. It's like, you know, it's like going to the store, and at the store there's this incredibly valuable thing that you've always wanted your whole life. And yet when you go to pay for it, you say, but if I pay for it, then I won't have this nice money anymore. I'm going to lose my money. I said, well, yeah, that's true, but that thing there is the thing that you've always wanted your entire life. What good's your money going to do you if you don't? Well, that's the choice we face. God is saying, I've got this thing for you. It's what Paul has been describing all throughout, what Jesus has done. The forgiveness he's brought, the life that he's brought, the inheritance he has promised us, that's what I can buy with my life. I can take the season of life that I have now and invest it in believing the gospel, reaching out for those promises, and in the end, entering into eternal life. That's the opportunity I have before me. But I'm easily seduced. And maybe I'm revealing too much about myself in this. I don't know if you see yourself in the same light. I am easily seduced by the world around me. I haven't noticed that you're all that different. I have been watching. Every now and again it occurs to me, maybe I'm just hanging around with the wrong people. Maybe there are all these people out there that don't have any of these struggles, and it just looks like a big struggle to me because I'm hanging around with a bunch of losers. But I don't think so. Or at least, if you are, you're my kind of losers. Because I seem to be the same sort of loser. The world that I live in is constantly, just by the very fact of my experience in that world, it's so easy for me to pick up the message, this is all there is. Well, I think that's the kind of thing that Paul is warning against. That in my dealing with the outside, with those outside the faith, I need wisdom, I need perspective, I need to understand what's really going on. Now he goes on to say, to talk about your word being in grace, seasoned with salt. If I understand this phrase, I think it helps to support the kind of thing that I'm talking about. And if I can try to do this quickly, but you'll remember in the Sermon on the Mount, in chapter 5 of Matthew, let me start reading in verse 10 of chapter 5 in Matthew. Blessed are those who have been persecuted for the sake of righteousness, for theirs is the kingdom of heaven. Blessed are you when men cast insults at you and persecute you and say all kinds of evil against you falsely on account of me. Rejoice and be glad, for your reward in heaven is great, for so they persecuted the prophets who were before you. You are the salt of the earth, but if the salt has become tasteless, how will it be made salty again? It is good for nothing anymore except to be thrown out and trampled underfoot by men. You are the light of the world. A city set on a hill cannot be hidden, nor do men light a lamp and put it under the peck measure, but on the lampstand, and it gives light to all who are in the house. Let your light shine before men in such a way that they may see your good works and glorify your Father who is in heaven. Now, what I wanted to say here is, I think all of that hangs together. The end of the Beatitudes, where he's talking about the blessings of being persecuted, what he's saying, in essence, is, look, the world has always responded to the people of God with a rejection of one kind or the other. Think about what happened to the prophets. Here are men who came with a message from God, and yet their own people, most of the time, ended up mistreating them, killing them. I mean, being a prophet was not an easy job. And yet, Jesus speaking to the Jews here in this situation, wouldn't you want to share in the reward of the prophets? If there's anybody that you would want to be like, wouldn't you like to be in the favor of God the way the prophets are in the favor of God? Well, what I'm saying to you is people who have lined up with God have always been rejected by the world around. So if you're going to follow me, if you're going to line up with me, then you're going to be out of step with the world around you. And that can end up with you being persecuted. But you're blessed because of it, because you don't want to line up with the world around you. You don't want to be like the world around you. It's going the wrong way. You're blessed to stick out. He says, a city set on a hill cannot be hidden. And, you know, think about how there are those places off the beaten track that part of their security is, look, we're kind of tucked away over here. There's no main roads going by. We're kind of tucked over behind the hills. And most of the bad guys who come walking by never even know that we're there, and they just pass us by altogether. But you have that city set on a hill. Everybody going by sees that city. You can't help it. It's, you know, here's this flat area all around it, and here's this hill, and the city's up on top of it. By its very nature, it's going to stick out. It's going to be noticed. Well, we stick out. We're going to be noticed if, in fact, we're following God. You know, I've often used that picture of, you know, the stream is going down this way, and we are those who crazily have turned around and are trying to swim against the current. And you can see that wake, all that white water, that thrashing going on there as we are swimming against the current. Everybody notices, look at that stupid fish, it's going the wrong way. Well, that's us. I mean, if we're following God, then we're not following the world around us. We're on a different path. And we're going to stick out. Now, I could decide, I don't want to stick out. I don't like it up on a hill. And that's where his language comes in. You are the salt of the earth, but if the salt has become tasteless, how will it be made salty again? I understand the emphasis on the salt here, not to be, sometimes you hear people talk about its preservative qualities, and I'm still not sure whether he means to include that in the picture. But think about this. He talks about the city set on a hill. What is it that in our experience we know about salt? If something's got salt in it, you taste it. Salt is salty. When you put salt on something, it's to make it taste salty. That's what it does. Salt that doesn't taste salty would be worthless. What am I going to do with salt that doesn't taste like salt? Oh, I think I'll put some more on? I mean, what good is that going to do? So the emphasis here, on when he talks about the saltiness is that distinctiveness. It's got that flavor that you can't miss. Well, now I say all of that stuff to come back to what Paul's saying about let your speech be with grace, seasoned with salt. I think it's a similar kind of thing. Conduct yourself with wisdom in the world. And as you are responding, so that you will know how to answer the people that you're dealing with in the world, let your speech be seasoned with salt. Let it be distinctive. Let it stay uniquely Christian. I don't mean using Christian jargon, but I mean let your perspective on life remain wise. Don't let the world suck you in. Don't let your salt become to lose its savor and to have no taste. Stay committed to what you are and what you believe in the midst of a world that is going another way. So if I understand the kind of exhortation that he's giving here, this is in essence to a group of people who have been listening to worldly fools and who are prepared to walk away from the apostolic gospel. He's telling them, no, remember what's true. Be wise in your dealing with other people and let your response to them be marked by the grace of God. I think what he means, I don't think he means be gracious, be nice to them when you talk, although some people interpret it that way. But I think he means let your speech, your word, be marked by the grace of God. Let it be informed by the grace of God. Let what you say show your understanding and commitment to the grace of God. Seasoned with salt. Let your speech be the speech of a person who understands the grace of God and will not go the way of the world. I think that's the kind of thing he's getting at. At any rate, certainly he makes those kinds of admonitions in many other places, so if I'm wrong in the way I've put it together, I don't think I'm far wrong. And certainly the message is one that is absolutely a biblical one. You and I face this challenge. You and I are living in a world that treats life as if what we've got here is all there is. And you and I, unfortunately, are people who are very easily prepared to believe that it's the case. So his warning is for us to remember what's true, to hold on to the wisdom that we have in the gospel in the face of the pressures to go another way. That's a warning that we always need to hear, I think. Well, what I'd like to do is just read to you the rest of the letter. This is just where he talks to various people. And just so that we can get it on the record, you've gone all the way through the entire book of Colossians. But I don't have a lot to say about it, and then I'd like the rest of the time for any questions or comments you may have. So I turned away from Colossians here, so I've got to get it back. Okay, starting in verse 7. As to all my affairs, Tychicus, our beloved brother and faithful servant and fellow bondservant in the Lord, will bring you information. For I have sent him to you for this very purpose, that you may know about our circumstances and that he may encourage your hearts. And with him, Onesimus, our faithful and beloved brother, who is one of your number. They will inform you about the whole situation here. And you may remember, Tychicus is the guy that Paul is sending the letter with. He also takes the letter to the Ephesians. Onesimus is a slave who ran away from his master, became a believer, has been working with Paul, and now Paul is sending him back. And we read about that in the letter to Philemon. Philemon is the master of Onesimus. Philemon lives in Colossae. Onesimus is from Colossae. So when Tychicus comes with this letter to the Colossians, he's also coming with a letter to Philemon, and Onesimus, the slave, is there with him. Aristarchus, my fellow prisoner, sends you his greetings, and also Barnabas' cousin Mark, about whom you received instructions. If he comes to you, welcome him. And also Jesus, who is called Justice. These are the only fellow workers for the kingdom of God who are from the circumcision, and they have proved to be an encouragement to me. Epaphras, who is one of your number, a bondslave of Jesus Christ, sends you his greeting, always laboring earnestly for you in his prayers, that you may stand perfect and fully assured in all the will of God. For I bear him witness that he has a deep concern for you and for those who are in Laodicea and Hierapolis. And I just might make a quick comment about that in light of what we said last week about prayer. This very much fits into the picture that I have here. Epaphras is showing his concern. Epaphras has heard the story about what's happening. Epaphras is the one who first preached the gospel in Colossae. He knows that these false teachers have come into the place and people are sort of trembling on the brink of going over to it. And what is his response? He is praying to God, don't let this happen to them. Let them become perfect and fulfilled in all your will. That is, let them become just what we saw Paul praying at the beginning. Let them become grounded in the faith and be wise and walk in the ways of the gospel and all of that stuff. That's the kind of thing that Epaphras is praying for. Luke, the beloved physician, sends you his greetings, and also Demas. Greet the brethren who are in Laodicea, and also Nympha and the church that is in her house. And when this letter is read among you, have it also read in the church of the Laodiceans. And you, for your part, read my letter that is coming from Laodicea. And I have commented on this before. I think, I would say it's even probable at this case, although people argue different ways, that what he calls the letter that is coming from Laodicea is the letter that we know of as Ephesians. It's very interesting. Here in Colossians, he's saying, I want you to have them read this letter, and I want you to read the letter that's coming from over there. What's confusing is the letter to the Ephesians is addressed Ephesians and not Laodiceans. But nonetheless, I think that's not relevant. And that what he means is, as Tychicus is traveling around, he's got this letter and various people are reading it, and he'll be coming to you from Laodicea, and when he comes, bringing that letter, I want you to read it. And say to Archippus, take heed to the ministry which you have received in the Lord, that you may fulfill it. I, Paul, write this greeting with my own hand. Remember my imprisonment. Grace be with you. Just another piece of evidence that Paul did not write out his own letters by hand, that he had somebody that he dictated it to. And at the end, he says, I write this greeting with my own hand. Evidently, it looked quite different than the rest of the letter would have. And it's speculated that he had problems with his eyes, and so maybe it was large or something like that. Okay, well, as I said, a letter sort of dribbles off to a high and by kind of conclusion, and that's what we did too. So now, here's your opportunity. Questions, comments, anything you might want to talk about anything we've talked about in Colossians or anything else in DNA.
Do you know who Archippus was and what his ministry was?
No, I don't.
Oh, darn.
No.
I'm intrigued about what you're doing with the part of your speech being seasoned with salt. Sort of coincidentally, this past week, last weekend, I went up to Portland for a family function. And as happens most of the time when I go up to see my cousins up there, I am convinced that I'm a changeling, and I have no idea how I managed to get into this family. But this time was particularly bad because I was sitting with some of my cousins and their wives / girlfriends that are, they're truly appalling people. And they don't seem to be able to talk about anything that is remotely edifying, and probably three-quarters of their speech, which people who know me know that as a biologist I don't have any problem talking about sex, but this is, the attitudes are just so, it's just painful to be in the midst of that. And just to give you an example, my cousin Jay, next to him was sitting his son Andrew, and Andrew's older brother, Jim, who's 18, didn't come home the previous night. And somebody heard that and said, "So, Jay, where's Jim? Is he okay? Do you know? Is he okay?" "Oh, he just probably got lucky." So this is in front of Andrew. I wanted to say, "Jay, what are you saying to your kid here?" So anyway, when I came home, I was actually really traumatized from being in the midst of that. And the next day, I was still so upset that I called into work and talked to one of my coworkers and said, "Would you mind if I took a vacation day today and just kind of deal with stuff, because I just kind of need to be quiet?" And he said, "Oh, sure, yeah, go ahead." And so the next day, I guess the word had gotten around to various people that something terrible had happened to me on Sunday, and I was sort of emotionally recovering from it. And so a couple of people were asking me what was going on, and I was trying to explain how, you know, I just had this mental image of wanting to pull my skin off to get clean somehow. And what was really funny was that they had no way to understand what was going on there. They kept on saying, well, sure, it was like pretty immature the way they were talking, you know, pretty not any class or anything. I'm saying, well, yeah, definitely immature, definitely no class, but immaturity and not having classy speech doesn't make me feel like I want to pull my skin off. And it occurred to me that they had no way to understand why it affected me the way it did. And when you're talking about this, you know, I suppose in a sense my speech was seasoned with salt because I was trying to explain to them why it affected me the way it did. But at the same time, I'm feeling this tug of, I'm really weird to them.
Right.
They, maybe what I should just do is say, yeah, you know, didn't have any class. You know, it was kind of low class talk.
Yeah.
That I could feel that tug, right. And so it was interesting to me that the idea that the more significant thing isn't necessarily for their sakes that your speech be seasoned with salt, because unless God has put them in a particular place, it can't do them any good. But it still is a significant thing for me to resist the temptation to not feel strange among them anymore and just kind of capitulate and say, oh yeah, you know, it's the immaturity, it's the, you know, not classy speech kind
right.
of thing that was really bothering me. That was the more significant thing, that it be okay with me to be weird and strange.
Right. Yes, that's what I'm saying. That's what's happening in the Ephesians passage, I think, and I think that's what's happening here, that it starts with, it's not, make sure that you get some real spicy zingers in to make sure that they, you know, get them thinking about stuff, but you yourself don't let the distinctiveness in your life go all flat and disappear when you're in the middle of the world. I think that's what he's saying. Now, it can have, I mean, the fact is that God may have people prepared to hear stuff at some time. So it can have a beneficial effect for the people that I'm talking to as well. But the issue is not so much how can I develop a strategy to get at them, so much as what this choice am I going to make about what I hold fast to and what I believe in the midst of these situations. Yeah, that's what I understand. And certainly, as I've said, if I'm wrong about what Colossians is doing, and it is, you know, it's just a short little verse, so maybe I'm reading too much into it, but this is a very common theme in the Bible, so I feel comfortable in preaching it anyway. I think it's absolutely true. If it's not what Paul means, I think it is what he means, but there are some, it's a question worth asking, certainly. Who else? You mean I haven't said anything the whole 3 months we've been doing this? I haven't said anything to get anybody mad, or anything you want to ask about or argue about? Or I must not have been trying hard enough. Well, why don't you go ahead and ask another question?
Just a sec.
Okay.
I was going to ask you after, but I'll just bring it up here.
Okay. Thanks.
I'm
kind of off on a tangent about the salt. And it might be that I don't understand salt or that I'm taking salt too far here.
Okay.
Does salt go bland? That's a question. I mean, does anybody know? I mean,
but...
Well, that's not it. That's not it.
Okay. Well, I have an answer I have an answer to that question
okay.
after you're
but,
done.
Maybe the more experienced cooks can correct me on this. But salt brings out the flavor of food, the right amount. Too much is yucky, I think.
Okay.
It does bring a distinct flavor, but that doesn't fit at all with what you're talking about. So maybe Paul didn't know that when he wrote it. I would think that God knew what he was doing when Paul wrote this stuff. But so I'm confused about that tangent. And
Okay, so I have two comments.
Okay.
First of all, for your little question at the beginning, first of all, it doesn't have to be physically possible for Jesus to make a statement like that. I mean, to say if the salt were to become unsalty, he wouldn't necessarily be implying that in the real world that could happen. But he could be talking about something, you know, if, as can't happen in the real world, what I'm calling the salt, you are the salt, but if you were to somehow become unsalty, which can't happen in the real world, but if you're the salt of the world and you back off and you walk away from the gospel because you don't want the world knowing that you're different, then you're salt that got unsalty. So it could be just that. But there is also to consider the fact that the way they got salt, what they called salt may very well have been something that had other minerals and stuff along with it. And what would happen to that stuff is that if it got wet, the salt would get leached out of it and the rest of the minerals would be left, so that you'd still have something left. This stuff they called salt is actually kind of a mixture of several things, and you'd still have something. You might look at it and say, okay, here's salt, and now it actually doesn't, it's not salty anymore because the salt got leached out of it. So that's another possibility as well, that he actually could be speaking from something in their experience. What we call salt is sodium chloride at this point, which is just, that's just salt. And you, either it's sodium chloride or else it isn't. So in that sense, but they may have been talking about something different. That's the little question you asked. Now the bigger one is the question of how we understand an analogy that's made in the Bible. This is a good example of that, because salt can do all kinds of things. There was a book that I read once that was about Christians and, you know, kind of social issues, how Christians should conduct themselves in the world towards social issues in government and that kind of thing. And the author said, well, it says that we're the salt of the earth, and salt, as we all know, is a corrosive that, you know, eats away at metal. And so we're supposed to be a corrosive eating away at the evil foundations of our society. Well, it's true. Salt can corrode things. But you can see that it starts to get to this point where, just because I can draw an analogy, does that mean that it's the analogy that the author meant when he said it? In fact, one of the key things to understand about an analogy is that analogies are intended to only go so far. It's a very rare analogy that can be pushed to the extreme, where every truth about the thing that I'm making the analogy to can be tied together with the thing in the analogical world. I mean, you know, Jesus made analogies, you know, about a son who takes his inheritance and goes off, and he's eating the corn cobs fed to the pigs. And we start to get to the point where if we were to say, well, you know, like corn cobs, what we get is something that used to have good food on it, but it's been chewed off by someone else. Well, that's true. I mean, that's true. That's what corn cobs are. But is that what he meant? Is that part of the analogy? So I would argue that when I want to understand what Jesus meant when he said, you're the salt of the earth, I have to go looking for the limits of that analogy. What is it? What is the comparison that he meant to make? And what I'm saying is, in the context, when you look at everything around it, about the being willing to be persecuted, the city set on a hill, you don't light a lamp and then put it under a bushel and that kind of stuff. He's talking about that this is meant to stand out. It is meant to be distinctive. And, you know, you don't take a lamp and then hide it so that the light is gone. A city set on a hill is distinctive by its very nature. You can't hide it. It's up there. And salt, if it stopped being salty, what good would it be? I mean, the whole point of salt is to be salty. So I'm arguing that the context shows me what he's thinking about, and that any other thing that I might do with salt is probably irrelevant because he has pointed me in a direction. So that's how I would look at that. Analogies are dangerous in that regard, in that I as the person, the recipient of the analogy, I always have to ask the question, where does the analogy break down? And a lot of times the author doesn't answer that for me. I have to decide. Given the topic, given what he's saying, where is it that the analogy stops being an analogy? And that's just the nature of the beast, I think. Okay, Logan?
I've read other religious literatures over time, and I've had a lot of conversations with people who accuse the Bible is just this compilation of manipulative stories designed to, you know, create a, you know, patriarchal social structure and blah, blah, blah. But it strikes me that in Paul's letters, he touches on such mundane things like, oh, and bring me the cloak I left there last time. Mm-hmm. So-and-so, the city councilor, says to say hi. And it strikes me that if anybody thinks this is just manipulative religious literature, right, they haven't read it. Yeah. Because people who are trying to create, you know, lights in the sky and angelic visions don't say things like, I wrote it with my own hand.
Right, right.
I mean, just this silly little day-to-day, everyday stuff, which doesn't, you know, create in me visions of heaven or anything like that.
Right.
And I think I'm coming to point that out to people when they say things like
right.
that.
So yeah, that's a good point. I like that.
I think one of the marvelous things is I was kind of thinking about what you were, I really appreciated your talking about salt and stuff, and what I realized in the context of this, that certainly the word kind of puts the parameters around the meanings, in a sense, is he's flowing in a certain direction and he sets some parameters, but there's some freedom inside those parameters. And so the essence of it is you have the word, which does have parameters in it, and yet you have the spirit, and we have the spirit in our lives, which applies that to our own life. In other words, as I see salt in the parameters, it has maybe certain meanings for me and the way that I should walk. That might not mean that for you, but it certainly does have certain meanings for me. And I think that's the marvelous thing about the Spirit and the Word. We don't have like a central authority figure who defines everything for us. That there's a sense in which the Spirit works and uses godly men as they teach that word to set the parameters for us, that help us in those parameters as we study and look, and then the Spirit then applies those words to our heart. I think that's the marvelous thing about the Spirit and the Word. And
okay, I really agree with you, unless you mean a particular thing, and then I don't. So let me say back to you what I would say that would. There's a distinction that I would want to make between the significance of a statement and its and the authorial intent of a statement, if you can allow me that language. When you talk about how being salt in a certain situation might mean something to me that wouldn't mean anything to you, I agree with that absolutely, in the sense that the principle that is being pointed to there has, in fact, a wide variety of situations in which it would speak to. It doesn't say, in situation X, always do Y. It says, here's the principle, here's what's at stake. Now, in this situation over here, that's going to translate itself into this. In this situation over here, it's going to look very different. In fact, in this situation over here, it might translate itself into the opposite of what it looked like over here. Over here, to follow the same principle meant to do something that over here it meant don't do that. Because the issue is, in both cases, the principle that I'm trying to follow, if we're talking about the saltiness here, is that idea that I am going to hold fast to the truths of the gospel in the world that I live in, that I'm going to retain the distinctiveness of the Christian faith and not back off of it because it makes things difficult for me. So you can see how, in one circumstance, in order to retain that saltiness, if the situation is one thing, I might think I really need to say something here. And in another situation, I might decide I really need to not say something here. And both of them are operating from the same principle, that I'm trying to keep my distinctiveness as a believer and so on. But I would say, if someone comes along and says to me, I'm supposed to be overthrowing the government because salt is a corrosive and I'm supposed to be eating away at the foundations, well, now the problem is that I have misunderstood the intent of what Jesus meant to say. Now, it's not that I have understood what he said and I'm applying it wrong. I haven't understood what he said. I can't take what he said and turn it into something that he didn't mean. He meant something. I got to find that. And then it's going to go in a variety of senses. Okay, but okay, unless the passage says you had better stop him from doing that, in which case then I'd better. Okay, right. Okay, good. Roger, this will be the last one.
At the beginning, I asked you a question. And you said you would answer it at the end. So here's the question again. What was the false teaching that the teachers were teaching that Paul was responding to?
Yeah. Well, that's good. I think I kind of got stronger on that as I went along, as we were studying through. I was kind of wishy-washy at the beginning, but sort of the more I saw, the more what strikes me is that there are a handful of strong indicators throughout the letter that the religious asceticism that they're being called to, keeping festivals, not eating this, not drinking this, and that kind of stuff that Paul is seeing as up against the gospel, I think there are some pretty good reasons to think that this is a Jew-Gentile sort of distinction. He keeps saying things that suggest that's at stake. And that would certainly fit when he talks about Sabbaths. It wouldn't have to be. There are other ways of understanding the concept of Sabbath, other ascetic kinds of traditions that would keep days of the week and stuff. But it would fit real well. And if that's the case, then in essence, the problem in Colossae could be somewhat similar to what we see in Galatians. He doesn't ever speak specifically to it the way he does in Galatians, that make it clear that it's the Judaizers and the historical circumstances about what happened and everything. But in essence, this is a teaching that says the way to be godly, the way to be a spiritual godly person is to eat and drink in a certain way and keep certain religious festivals and days and that sort of stuff. So whether it's Christians, like the Judaizers were Jewish believers in Jesus. They believed that Jesus was the Messiah, but added to that the idea that you have to keep the law. Whether in Colossae it's something like that, or it's a group that is actually sort of pitting itself against Christianity and saying, no, you know, Jesus, this Jesus stuff doesn't quite have it. You need to be over here. That's a little harder to say. The fact that Paul throughout the letter so often emphasizes the supremacy of Christ, the all-sufficiency of Christ, and all of that kind of thing, makes me wonder if perhaps that the teaching hasn't and somehow not just added something to the message of Christ, but actually somehow set him aside. So if I had to vote right now, I would say the teaching involves Jewish asceticism with at least a de-emphasizing of the role of Christ in our access to God. Something like that. Okay, well, let's stop. Thanks for coming to all of this.